You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. Voters will choose a District 5 supervisor this November. Three candidates are challenging sitting supervisor Valley Brown to represent District 5, which includes the Fillmore and Western Addition, Japantown, Inner Sunset, Haight-Ashbury, and Lower Pacific Heights. Here today is Dean Preston, a tenants' rights advocate and founder of Tenants Together, who's running for the seat. Dean, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
So your district includes neighborhoods with really different characters and probably different interests. Which part of the district do you live in?
Well, I live right near Alamo Square, and actually, you know, in what at one time all of our adjoining neighborhoods there were the Western Addition, but, you know, the real estate agents like to rename every few blocks as they become trendy. So I think I live in Alamo Square officially now, and spend a lot of time on Divisadero in my neighborhood, and then also my kids go to school over in Coal Valley, so I'm over there a lot too.
Do you think different neighborhoods in the district have different top priorities, and what might some of those priorities be?
I think the priorities do vary. I think that the housing affordability crisis, though, cuts across the whole district, and when I'm out talking to voters, that is at the top of everyone's list. Also, homelessness issues are big across the district. But certainly, the issues do vary neighborhood to neighborhood. And one of the beauties of running in a district is you really are out there talking with folks about everything from, you know, the big issues facing the city, but also the, you know, the tree removal in their neighborhood or the dangerous intersection at the corner. And those things do vary a lot by neighborhood. But we also, you know, District 5 reflects a lot of the inequality that is across our city, but also even within District 5. So we have areas that are where folks are, you know, much better off financially than other areas. We have certain communities, particularly in the Fillmore, that have really been hit so hard by displacement and by racist policies at the city level and from real estate speculation. So the issues do vary, but overall, a lot of the challenges are similar.
I want to get into a lot of those points later, but first I want to know a little bit more about you. You founded Tenants Together, which you say is the only statewide tenant advocacy group. Can you tell us about some of the organization's achievements at the state level?
Sure. So I formed Tenants Together in 2008, and that was at a time when there was a statewide ballot measure that would have abolished rent control in California. So the real estate industry had done that successfully in some other states. They basically just went over the heads of local cities and just made rent control illegal, and they were trying to do that in California. So I started talking with folks who were doing local tenant advocacy work. I was at the time an eviction defense lawyer. I was representing tenants who were facing eviction, suing big real estate speculators to prevent conversions of rent control housing. But a lot of the impediments to protecting tenants were bad state laws, and things were about to get even worse if rent control was abolished. So I started talking with folks who were doing similar work, who were tenant rights attorneys, heads of tenants unions, folks all over the state, and no one really talked to each other at all. Everyone was fighting the same battles in city after city. And that's where the idea came together in the face of that really awful ballot measure that would have eliminated rent control, to try to connect those dots across the state and actually build more well-coordinated statewide movement that could take on the real estate interests in Sacramento and build power locally, not just in San Francisco, but across the state. So it's now developed into a coalition of over 50 local grassroots organizations that are fighting evictions in their community. Tenants Together has formed new and helped local activists form new tenants unions and tenant rights organizations in cities that have never had that in California, and has also connected the existing organizations like the San Francisco Tenants Union and the Housing Rights Committee of San Francisco and others to their sister organizations all over the state. So we've had some huge wins, starting with leading the fight to defeat that ballot measure and save rent control in California. So that's how we got started. Started off with a bang in 2008, leading the fight to save rent control. And then have, over the years, fought for better state laws, fought to kill bad ideas in Sacramento, and also to pass stronger local protections for tenants. So moving on from that battle to save rent control to trying to make sure that the huge pension funds, CalPERS and CalSTRS, which were actually financing mass eviction deals. We led the campaign at the state level with Tom Amiano that time to actually ban those kind of investments by CalPERS and CalSTRS, so basically keeping billions of dollars.
What were these funds investing in that led or was connected to evictions?
For example, in the city of East Palo Alto, one real estate speculator and his group bought up half the rent-controlled housing in the entire city, and we uncovered the fact that they were being financed by CalPERS and CalSTRS. They were using workers' retirement money to do mass evictions in the city of East Palo Alto of working-class folks. So we exposed that and got them to actually change their policies and divest from those kind of deals. After that, we move right into defending tenants in the foreclosure context. Right, this was in 2008, 2009, when there were thousands and thousands of foreclosures occurring. Huge attention on the plight of homeowners, understandably, who were losing their homes through foreclosure. No one was paying attention to the fact that a huge chunk of those properties were occupied by tenants who, when the bank would foreclose, they'd just kick everyone out. And so we did a series of reports on the plight of tenants in foreclosure. We passed state legislation to grant additional protections to tenants in foreclosed properties as part of what was called the Homeowner Bill of Rights. We wrote the tenant rights portions of that bill and plugged up some very serious loopholes that the banks were using to kick renters out of their homes. It's been, really an exciting organization to be a part of and to found and help lead. And I only recently stepped away to and turned the reins over so I could run for office.
You describe yourself as a democratic socialist. This is not an unfamiliar term in San Francisco, but I want to get you to talk a little bit about what that means to you. Does it refer to being active with the Democratic Socialists of America, or is it more of a statement of support for certain policies? Is it a philosophical stance? What does it mean exactly?
Well, all of the above, I would say. And I think I am an active member of Democratic Socialists of America, the San Francisco chapter. Proud to be endorsed by the DSA local chapter as well as the DSA national. And I do think that identifying as a democratic socialist and being part of DSA involves having a view of the role of government in our lives and the role of standing up to corporate interests in a way that is different from folks who don't share that label. I think fundamentally elevating the needs of people over the needs of profit and looking at the systems that we have in place in which through decades now of Republican rule as well as neoliberal democratic rule, we've looked again and again to the private market to try to solve our problems. And the problems have gotten worse. And I think folks who are involved in democratic socialism really reject the idea that we're going to find solutions to our problems by relying more and more on large corporations to solve the problems. So whether that's Medicare for all and rejecting the idea that we should have a primarily private insurance system that occasionally does the right thing or can be forced to do the right thing in some situations while millions of people remain uncovered, right? I think folks in DSA are very clear that the government, we should have Medicare for all. I think it's similar with most any other issue. Housing, certainly where I've focused. And, you can try to solve a housing crisis by building a bunch of luxury market rate housing that nobody can afford to live in, which is great for the investors, and then require some small percentage to be affordable housing and pat yourself on the back that you're solving the housing crisis by doing that. I don't think that solves the housing crisis. I don't think anyone in DSA thinks that is solving the housing crisis. I think we need to reorient around solutions like building social housing, building 100% affordable housing, especially on public land. So I think that's the shift that democratic socialists want to see is moving away from the reliance on private interests, private capital, and corporate power to solve problems when they've shown again and again that they're making our problems worse.
Let's talk more about housing and the role of the public and role of private interests. But first, do you rent or own?
I own my home. I've been a renter and a homeowner in the district.
Do you know if the majority of your constituents rent or own?
Majority rent.
So in March of this year, a report came out looking at California City's failure to meet regional housing goals. And if current trends continue, San Francisco would take decades to meet its low-income housing goals. But San Francisco would hit its current very low-income goal in 2030 and its low-income target in 2025, and then its above-moderate income goal this year. It's on track to meet it. In 2014, the general plan's housing element included a breakdown of how far along San Francisco was, and at that point, we had percentages. We built around 40% of the low-income housing goal, just 16% of the moderate-income housing goal, and a full 97% of the above-moderate income goal. For whom is affordable housing your top priority? Is it supportive housing for the formerly homeless, middle-income family housing, very low-income housing, something completely different? Which part of affordable housing is your top priority?
Well, I think those statistics that you laid out are really powerful and make the case that our obsession in this city with discussing market rate housing and how much of it, or you know, how many floors, how much density, all that is kind of missing the point, which is, you know, that we as a city have actually hit our goals and in some cases exceeded our goals for the production of market rate housing, and that the failure has been, as you just laid out in those statistics, the failure has been to provide for the needs of low income, working class, middle class San Franciscans. And so, you know, what we need to do as a city is make the creation of affordable housing the top priority. I feel very strongly that we cannot and really need to resist the urge to take from one group of folks who are struggling to deliver for another group who are struggling. What I mean by that, there have been some efforts led by the real estate industry to try to redefine affordable housing and to try to basically take units that are allocated for low-income families in San Francisco and provide those to middle or upper middle class San Franciscans. So I believe we need to grow the pie, and we need to be providing more housing both for middle class and for low income San Franciscans. But I'll never support a policy that takes housing away from folks who are struggling the most in order to house folks who are also struggling to stay in San Francisco, but who are in that middle income bracket. So when you see proposals like Prop E on the ballot this year, for example, right, which would provide for 100% affordable housing on public land, like that's a step forward. And then that measure has a range of incomes within its definition of affordability. But there you're growing the number of units and you're broadening out who qualifies for them. I favor social housing. And if you look at countries, you got to look outside the U.S. for really robust examples of successful social housing programs. And if you look at, you know, a place like Vienna, for example, where over 60% of the population lives in social housing, and it's mixed income, but they made an investment and made it a priority now for decades to provide municipally owned housing for the folks who live in that city. And people who live in that kind of housing are there for life if they want to be. They don't live under this constant fear of being displaced. So I know we can't do that overnight, but if we're not building toward that in San Francisco so that folks, whether they're low income or middle income, can actually afford below market opportunities to live and stay in San Francisco, the crisis will just keep raging.
You promised to work to create 10,000 units of municipally owned social housing on public land with innovative resident-controlled governance. First of all, in what time frame? And second, can you break that down a little bit more, municipally owned and resident-controlled governance? Those sound like they suggest something different from how most of the affordable housing in the city right now is run, which is being built in some cases and operated by private nonprofits. Is there a difference there?
Well, so the we look at a site like Midtown Apartments in San Francisco and in District 5 is an example where we have the opportunity to do social housing. It's city-owned property. The residents, there's a history actually where the residents were promised early on a level of ownership or control of the property that has not materialized. So the city is sitting there with, and it's very controversial, what's going to happen there? I've been working with the residents now for a number of years. The city was planning to demolish Midtown Apartments and rebuild there. And it was very controversial, and the residents fought that, and we've now gotten the city to back off the demolition plan. But you know, Midtown Apartments could be a real example of how to do social housing in a way that is municipally owned, that takes the profit motive, essentially, out of the real estate. That's what drives the prices up. And provides resident control through, you can do resident councils, you can do a percentage ownership. There are co-op models and land trust models which do this already, which balance some split of ownership, basically, between the city and the residents and takes the speculation out of the housing. Just starting with public lands, people often talk about that there's no land in San Francisco. It's not true. I mean, this is certainly a city where, that is pretty dense and where it's hard to find vacant lots, but they exist, and there's quite a lot of public land that could be developed for affordable housing. Just in District 5, for example, I mean, look at the DMV. Right, you know, between Oak and Fell. It's a huge lot that just right now is used for some parking. So, you know, put some parking underground and you could build a ton of units on that site. And you know, there are other sites like that that are either underutilized or not utilized at all. And I do think that a social housing model is one we need to move toward.
So does this move away from having nonprofits engaged in administrating essentially affordable housing?
Well, I think the nonprofits right now play a key role in providing the affordable housing in San Francisco. So I think that and some of them, even if it were city owned, would be involved in the management and the So I don't think I'm proposing anything that's stripping away the role of nonprofit housing providers. I do think, though, that a shift toward maintaining public ownership of the property, especially on public land, is a little different. So right now, sometimes the nonprofits own the buildings. Sometimes they do a master lease program, whereas as a private owner, I certainly would like to see us complementing that by also with a focus initially at least on public land, with the city maintaining ownership. Part of why I emphasize Midtown Apartments and some specific sites is important with some of these bigger ideas to recognize that, we're not going to suddenly shift decades of non-investment in social housing overnight, right? Like we have to have some project where we show how it can work. And that becomes the model for other social housing development.
So that leads me to ask again, I didn't give you a chance to answer this really, but 10,000 units in what time frame?
Yeah, I mean, I view that as if I win office and then am in there for two terms, I mean, I view that as like a decade-long goal, basically. It would be during the time that I were a supervisor if I were elected and reelected. But also, I think we could do more than that, potentially. I also always caution people who their eyes, get big when I talk about 10,000 units and they say, well, how are you going to build 10,000 units? And I correct them, you don't have to necessarily build it all, right? The city can acquire property. The city can acquire property that is not rent controlled right now. We should be looking at what would it cost to acquire some of these buildings, some of these places like Fillmore Center, others that have units that are not subject to rent control. What would it cost? Whenever you propose that in San Francisco, people think it's crazy, right? Whenever you're going to buy land or buy units, it always looks like it's prohibitively expensive until you look at it a decade later, right? And you think about, what if 20 years ago in San Francisco, when people started talking about this, when activists like myself were talking about how we need that kind of shift, what if we'd bought up all the vacant land 20 years ago, right? What if we had bought up apartment buildings that were not rent controlled and made them city-owned social housing. So I do sometimes push back when people are looking only at creating affordable housing opportunities as ground-up construction, because you got to do both creating new housing in that way, but you can also acquire existing housing that's unaffordable and as a city make it affordable.
You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. We'll continue our conversation with Dean Preston, candidate for the District 5 seat, in a moment.
KSFP would like to thank the awesome, forward-thinking institutional supporters of the San Francisco Public Press, including the San Francisco Foundation, the James Irvine Foundation, the Reva and David Logan Foundation, Craig Newmark Philanthropies, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, the Fund for Nonprofit News at the Miami Foundation, the Fund for Investigative Journalism, the California Endowment, the Center for Cultural Innovation, the Institute for Nonprofit News, and the local independent online news publishers. This is KSFP LP San Francisco, 102.5 FM.
Welcome back to Civic. Let's hear more from Dean Preston, who's running for election to the District 5 supervisor's seat. So you wrote Proposition F, which is a 2018 ballot measure that, after voters approved it, established the right to legal counsel for every tenant facing eviction. A little more than a year later, how would you evaluate the impact of that measure?
Well, it's definitely already had an impact, and we've talked to folks who are getting representation who wouldn't have previously and have been able to avoid eviction. It's too soon to know whether it's actually decreased the eviction filings. What we know from New York City, which is we were the second city to do this. New York did it before us. They did it a year before. They rolled it out in just certain zip codes. They did it 5 zip codes. A year later, the evictions had dropped almost in half.
Wow.
In those 5 zip codes. And so we cautiously predicted when we were campaigning for Prop F in 2018 that it might reduce evictions by, say, 25-30%. It looks like it could be even larger than that. So there's no question it's having an impact. This was something that the city had promised to do years ago in a hollow and some might say fairly meaningless declaration, at the board that the city would become a right to counsel city, but that with legislation that David Chu authored, that there was a lot of press about. But the same legislation said in it, this states the intention to become a right to counsel city, but does not actually create the right to counsel. So, it was a first step. We weren't critical of it at the time. You got to start somewhere. But 5 years later, when people still did not have a right to counsel, when, more than 2/3 of folks facing eviction were in court alone, and anyone knows if you go into court alone against a landlord who has a lawyer, you are most likely going to lose. And that's what was happening. And so we did Prop F. And it was at the start, many folks viewed it as too sweeping, too radical, too many questions about it. There was a lot of pressure to try to limit the scope of who would get representation. We rejected all that and we said, look, people who are facing eviction, especially in San Francisco, where an eviction means not just losing your home, but is either going to land you on the streets or result in you leaving the Bay Area. For most people, that's the reality of eviction. Everyone should be represented. And so it passed. It passed by like a 10-point margin, decisively. And the city has been taking steps to implement it. I've certainly been alarmed by the recent reporting from the Examiner on some questions on implementation and in terms of the funding for it.
So I want to ask you about that. You've said we need to fully implement
absolutely.
Prop F. What exactly remains to be done?
I mean, this is, and just in the scheme of things, this is, was estimated the cost of about $4 million in a $12 billion budget This city has a mandate from voters to fully fund legal representation for any tenant facing eviction. I have mixed feelings on where we are right now. Like, I want to give credit where it's due that the city has ramped up its implementation in advance of the deadline, which was in July. It was supposed to be fully implemented by July. And the level of eviction defense services has increased dramatically in the city. So that's the positive side. The negative side is there's no excuse for not fully funding the program. And what the advocates on the ground, the folks, the service providers will tell you is that they haven't gotten the full funding they need to ramp up the hiring so that everyone has not just representation, but representation from the time they get their eviction notice all the way through a court case and up through judgment. That's the promise of Prop F. I think the city is putting itself at risk if they don't provide that. I actually think that individual tenants could potentially, if they don't get representation, bring legal action against the city. I don't think there's a real choice for the city here. I understand that some from the mayor on down, were not thrilled about Prop F and are certainly under, pressure perhaps to not fully fund it. But this can be fully funded and fully implemented. And we're on the path to get there. But I think that it has to be done now. The city's had over a year to implement it. This is a program that is going to save people from eviction. There's no question about it.
Do you expect any impact on demand for these services in anticipation in perhaps eviction attempts in anticipation of a statewide rent cap law that landlords might be trying to get people out in advance of that being implemented?
Well, I think the statewide rent cap law does not impact the rent control tenants of San Francisco. So, so in those units, the rent increases are set by the
sure.
by the rent board. So, for most tenants in San Francisco, the new statewide law isn't going to change the allowable rent increases. I think that the existence of Prop F and the full implementation of that program is going to result in decreased number of evictions filed.
Oh, acting as a deterrent.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And that's recognized even when the controller did their analysis of Prop F and they sketched out what it would cost, in the range of $5 million. It was a range 4.5 to 5.2, I think. But they also acknowledged that there could be significant savings from decreased eviction activities and also decreased services for once folks are evicted and homeless. And that's what's happened everywhere that has piloted a right to counsel. So when I say we were the second city to do it, there are other cities that had done small pilot projects, and all of them showed that when you provide a right to counsel to tenants, you decrease evictions and you save the city money in the long run. And the long run, in some cases, just a couple years. Like, you really see those results pretty quickly.
You've said that you're not interested in sitting down with State Senator Scott Wiener to discuss his proposal to spur development of housing near transit, SB 50. That's a proposal that has since been shelved. How do you think the state and the city should work together to encourage housing construction?
So, and just to put that comment in context, it came from a debate organizations like Tenants Together, many of the member organizations of our coalition, have spent years trying to sit down with Scott Wiener and persuade him to include things that would actually prevent gentrification and displacement when you're doing housing development. There has been some progress that some of those groups have made on certain issues, but when it comes to some of the fundamental issues around spurring the kind of luxury condo development that SB 50 would spur in a city like San Francisco, he has been unwilling to budge on the issues that would actually make his bill one that was a net positive. And so I think for those of us who have been involved in advocating around these bills, there's a certain point where you reach a conclusion that the purpose of the bill is to generate money for developers, and that those developers are controlling the legislation. Yes, I reached a conclusion after this is, Senator Wiener's third bill of this type. While folks have been able to pressure and get some concessions. I don't think he's the right author, frankly, for this kind of legislation. So while everyone was...
Why is that?
Well, while everyone was talking about SB 50 so much, nobody was talking about a similar bill that Richard Bloom, who is who I think cares more about the equity issues, was doing out of Santa Monica that would have spurred development in suburban communities that had been that have exclusionary zoning, exclusionary practices, are in desperate need of rental housing, and would have taken that on. The problem with what Senator Wiener continues to do is he uses the narrative of how we need to build in these suburban communities, but his bill's primary impact will be on the gentrifying, red-hot real estate market communities of San Francisco, Los Angeles, similar communities where housing prices are out of control. So what he's doing is these are developer giveaways. SB 50 is a straight-up developer giveaway. It allows developers by right the ability to build higher and denser pretty much anywhere in the city and county of San Francisco without increasing the rate of affordability that developers have to build, without increasing the rate of transit investments that developers have to make. It is so bad as a policy and so mischaracterized in the media. I mean, it's almost amusing, if it wasn't so sad, the polling that Senator Wiener and his allies did around SB 50 to show how popular it was. They said, would you support increased density near transit if it gave you more affordability in transit investments? Well, who wouldn't? I mean, of course, in San Francisco. But that's not what the bill does. And it's different from all the other efforts at the state and local level that have had a trade-off, that have said if developers are going to get these bonuses, that they have to give back more to the community. And Senator Wiener's bills never say that. And I think it's because it's the developers that those bills are written for and by. And so I'm very proud of my position. I think that most folks in District 5 share the position of they can see a developer giveaway when it's right in front of them. That's what SB 50 was. And if we're going to be giving away valuable development rights, we sure as hell should be getting more affordable housing back.
You've also said in a debate or town hall, if you're a rogue landlord, we should run you out of town. What's a rogue landlord to you, and how would you go about doing that?
You got all my fun quotes. This is great. that's a great question. A rogue landlord is a landlord like someone like Ann Kahagi, who was basically driven out of West Hollywood, prosecuted for the rogue nature that she ran her business, came up here, got sued by the city attorney repeatedly. You read the complaint and you'd be appalled that someone like this is allowed to operate rental property. I tangled for a decade in litigation with City Apartments and the former Skyline Realty. Allegations from tenants about security thugs showing up at their door, with a gun on a holster, tapping it and talking about wanting to talk to the tenants about the relocation plan, right? I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And frankly, when the first tenant or two came to me on these things, I wondered if it was accurate. And then when you have 10, 20 tenants tell you the same thing, you realize what's going on. I think the bigger issue here is, and I often turn this back on people, why would we not license landlords? I mean, you need a driver's license to operate a motor vehicle. You need a license to buy and sell real estate. You need a license to serve a drink to someone in a bar. And yet you can own thousands of rental units and not even have a license, not even be required to have some minimum education about what your obligations are as a landlord. And then you can violate the law. You can violate it blatantly, even criminally, and still own property and keep renting it out. You never get driven out of that business. Right? The one I mentioned, City Apartments and Skyline Realty, Dennis Herrera sued them. The only reason they don't operate in San Francisco is because they got $6 million of their fine waived if they agreed to leave San Francisco. I think the idea of driving these kind of landlords out of town, not only is it popular, it's just common sense. We should be licensing landlords and folks who are really across that line and don't know how to operate as a responsible business person. They are putting people's lives at risk. They should not be able to rent property out and have that be their business here in San Francisco.
You also propose a vacancy tax. Your campaign says that an estimated 33,000 units in San Francisco may be currently vacant. What's that estimate based on, and why is taxing vacant dwellings a goal for you?
Yes. So, you know, the vacancy issues are really important to look at, especially when the overall narrative is around building more market rate housing. A lot of this housing, once built, sits vacant. So even if you believe...
How do we know how much, though?
Yeah, so there have been some studies done. I think the Council of Community Housing Organizations put out there. There was also a legislative analyst from Board of Supervisors. So, you know, with a range of estimates, we don't have like a registry system. So it could be much larger than that. So you can tell what's owner-occupied or not by assessor records and whether someone claims a homeowner's exemption, which says that they live there. But because they don't have to register their rentals, it can be harder to get an exact figure. It's definitely tens of thousands. You know, you can also just anecdotally, I mean, you can just walk by any of these buildings, especially South of Market, these condo buildings, and just look and see. There's never a light on, and they are investments. And it makes sense for an investor, right? If you are, you know, a Wall Street-based investor, or you're in New York or Chicago or overseas and you're trying to invest, you know, there's stocks, there are bonds, there's different things you could put money in. San Francisco real estate's a pretty good investment for those folks. So they buy condos. Some of them own many condos, let them sit vacant. They're not interested in renting out. They're not in the business, really, of being a landlord. They're certainly not in the business of living in the property. They're just going to hold it for 5 years, 10 years, and then flip it. And that's been a pretty good investment in San Francisco. So I think it's essential that we have some form of vacancy tax. It's been done a little more in Canada. Oakland just passed a version on vacant land. And so, you know, I think we're starting to see some momentum. But this is one of these things where the real estate industry is dead set against a vacancy tax. And you can talk to people in District 5. You can talk to most anyone we talk to loves the idea of a vacancy tax, except for the folks who will put millions of dollars into opposing a ballot measure that would create it. They are not with me in this race. They're funding the attack ads against me, in fact, and the California Association of Realtors. And an idea like a vacancy tax, they view as a huge threat, not just because of what it will do in San Francisco, but because it could have a ripple effect with other cities across the nation.
We've been talking with District 5 Supervisor candidate Dean Preston. We'll be back shortly. You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press.
KSFP and the San Francisco Public Press are supported by listeners like you. Learn more about our membership program and join the public press at sfpublicpress.org/donate. You can make a donation online or send a check to the San Francisco Public Press, 44 Page Street, Suite 504, San Francisco, California, 94102. Thank you, and thanks to the thousands of donors who have made our work possible for 10 years. This is KSFPLP, San Francisco 102.5 FM.
Welcome back to Civic. Let's go back to our conversation with Dean Preston, who's running for the District 5 supervisor seat. We could talk for hours about housing, but I do want to touch on a couple of other issues, including transit, because San Francisco is so far from meeting its Vision Zero goals. That Vision Zero was started in 2014, an initiative to get San Francisco to zero traffic deaths by 2024. This year, if current trends continue, we will actually exceed the number of traffic deaths in San Francisco that we had in 2014. You've expressed support for a variety of traffic safety measures. What are some problem areas in your district, and what are your top priorities for addressing traffic safety there?
We have a crisis in the streets. As you say, a lot of time and energy has gone into Vision Zero, and yet the deaths and the injuries persist, and we're halfway through the 10-year plan, and we're nowhere near realizing the Vision Zero goals. So, in our district, we have a number of high injury areas, certainly around the panhandle on Baker and Fell has been the site of injuries and death. We have areas near some of the senior centers in particular have been, and Geary is very unsafe for pedestrians. So I think there are some hot spots and things that we can do to calm traffic in those areas, have more of a presence, including near senior centers, I think crossing guards or similar folks who can actually be there to help folks would be helpful. But the broader problem is that we have not prioritized public transportation and in the city, that we have turned the streets over to unregulated vehicles, basically unregulated cabs with Uber and Lyft. We have anywhere from 30,000 to 50,000 of them operating at any given time on the streets. And the city has failed to really stand up to that, has allowed the vehicular traffic to get to the point where we have incredible congestion. And we need to shift our focus and invest much more seriously in our public transportation system, especially as the city is growing, as well as doing the kind of street level, corner by corner improvements that are going to make cyclists and pedestrians more safe.
Totally unrelated, but the city charter has a ban on city workers striking, and you proposed repealing that ban. Can you talk a little bit about how that would serve workers and city residents?
Yeah, I think it's outrageous that we have a ban on the right to strike in a union town like San Francisco. So I would support repealing that. That would have to be done at the ballot because it's part of our charter. But in the short term, the city could also just not enforce it. And I think it's of questionable legality. What it does by taking the right to strike off the table for any workers is it just decreases their negotiating position. If you start negotiating with any, whether it's with the city, whether it's with a private boss, whoever that is, if you are a union and you are negotiating with a boss, and from the start you do not have the right to strike, that is your biggest piece of leverage, frankly. And often very important for the city, beyond the wages and the benefits, is the issue of outsourcing, which is of huge concern for city workers. So to not be able to strike seems like a real stifling of the rights of workers, and really what I view as a fundamental right. And I should say, I've done a lot of work in the housing context. We did a bill just last year that the real estate industry killed that would have established a right to strike for tenants in California.
Oh, like rent strikes.
Rent strikes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's the same philosophy and idea here, which is that, you need a right to strike in order to show whoever the decision maker is that you mean business and that you feel so strongly about something that if your demands are not met, that you're going to go out on strike. And nobody goes out on strike. I don't care if it's a tenant on a rent strike or a worker in any workplace. Nobody goes out on strike lightly. Nobody takes that decision lightly. It's a huge decision. But at some point, if things get so bad that someone needs to do that, we should not be standing in their way. And certainly in San Francisco, of all places, we are proudly a union town. There is no place in our charter for a ban on right to strike. It's belittling and takes away worker power, and we should get rid of it.
I want to talk a little bit about who is financially supporting your campaign. You have many donors at the $500 level. Some of them include Pramila Jayapal in the U.S. House of Representatives, the CEO of BASA, which is a cannabis dispensary, a lot of tenant lawyers, I guess unsurprisingly, handful of donors who work in tech. How do your values align with some of your top donors, as it were, and where do they diverge?
We have, I think, probably the cleanest money campaign that I've ever seen in the city. I mean, so there's huge sources of money that we're not taking at all. So just from the outset, we pledged not to take money from law enforcement, from big real estate. We haven't been seeking the endorsements from big real estate, the PACs, and any of their financial support from the charter school movement that's been trying to get into local politics and divert money from public schools, charter schools. So we have not taken any of that money. So what you see in our public filings of who our donors are is an incredible range of folks, you know, in all kinds of walks of life, from teachers, social workers, tech workers, you know, just lots of folks. But what's really, I think, the theme and the thing that connects them is these are not folks who are giving to us because of a perceived advantage at City Hall on policy. I mean, if you look at the folks who are supporting us, it's because they believe in this campaign, and you don't see the usual players who are in there funding both sides often in order to have an advantage when land use issues and other things come before the board. So I'm very proud of the amount that we've been able to raise without in any way compromising those values. It's only the donations of $100 or more where the person's name and occupation are listed. We have far outpaced our opponent in small donations. And you can look at the ethics filings. It shows the amount of under $100 donations. But those aren't itemized. And when you look at those are overwhelmingly folks from District 5, from San Francisco, and folks who are giving $5, $10, $20, $50, $75 to our campaign. And that's very exciting as a candidate to see that kind of money powering us.
One of the measures on this ballot would force independent expenditure committees to disclose their top three financial backers when they pay for a political advertisement or for campaign materials. And it would also limit contributions made by people or companies that are involved in land use matters worth more than $5 million that the city has to decide on still. Where do you stand on Proposition F?
I totally support it, and I think the more transparency, the better. I'd also go further. I think LA has been looking at a ban on developers donating to supervisor races and or city council there, and you know, I would support something similar in San Francisco. Because of the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, these independent expenditure committees are unlimited in their donations, and you know, where we raise money with a limit of $500 per donation, you know, Ron Conway or the Realtors Association, you know, can write a $100,000, $200,000 check. Just this last week, we got hit with the first attack mailers that are funded 100% by the California Association of Realtors that are directly and personally attacking me and my campaign. And I think the more transparency, the better. I'm glad at least that mailer says on the bottom, funded by the California Association of Realtors, because it could be worse. And what we've seen in other supervisor races is the same kind of hit pieces coming out, but they're by these very vaguely defined groups, and it takes months to figure out who is behind it. So what Prop F will do, this year's Prop F, will actually require greater disclosure, and I'm all for that.
I want to give you a chance to mention any work that you've done recently that I did not give you a chance to talk about that you want to throw out there.
I led the District 5 outreach and worked with many members of our team around last year's Proposition C, the tax on the biggest corporations, those earning over $50 million a year, to fund solutions to homelessness. So I'm very proud of our work collectively as a team getting the word out. We got a lot of votes. I was one of the early backers of that measure, Our City, Our Home. And that money has been collected but tied up in court. And we're, you know, hoping to get that money on the field. It's just outrageous that these companies that opposed that proposition are now tying up the money that's so critical for funding, one of the top issues in the city, which is actually addressing homelessness in a more serious way. So, to me, affordable housing, evictions and displacement and homelessness are all so closely tied. That's been my work over the last 20 years as an activist, as an attorney, and what I hope to prioritize if I'm elected supervisor.
Well, Dean, thank you so much for coming in and talking with me.
Thanks so much.
That was Dean Preston, running for District 5 supervisor in San Francisco. You've been listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. I'm Laura Wenis.